Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 80. On this episode, we are talking about Spectre, the 24th Bond film. This one starring Daniel Craig, the last few have. You probably recognize that. These Daniel Craig films are a little bit darker, a little more serious. So we take that on. We tackle the various ways that people think Bond films should go. What makes a classic Bond film? What makes a good Bond film? What just makes a good film? And how does that differ from a good Bond film? Lots to talk about, really great. So I bring on two Bond fans, guys that have gone way back with the series. That's Mark Wingerter from Real World Theology. You'll probably recognize him. And then Joel Mayward from Cinemayward. So make sure you're checking out cinemayward.com. Make sure you're checking out Mark's writing at Real World Theology. It's good stuff. You can find all the show notes to get those links at realworldtheology.com. We've got tons of reviews, lists, lots of other Bond reviews. So you'll probably enjoy that. Follow Real World Theology. Join our discussion group, our discussion page on Facebook. We've had a lot of good discussions there already, and we're continuing to. So we hope you join in those discussions. Follow us on Twitter. Subscribe to the podcast. We have tons of ways to do it. Feedburner, Stitcher, iTunes. We've got lots of great shows coming up, guys. Our Star Wars minisodes are coming out, so I hope you guys are enjoying those leading up to The Force Awakens. We will be covering The Force Awakens. We've got tons of Star Wars reviews. Star Wars. I hope you're hearing that. We've also got Good Dinosaur, Mockingjays coming out, so be on the lookout. We got lots of good reviews for you. In the meantime, this is a really great show, and we hope that you enjoy it. So, here it is, episode 80, Spectre and Being Bond.
Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless.
Joel, do you remember when the first time you ever saw a Bond movie was?
Oh, man, the first time I ever saw a Bond movie? It probably was on TV, like one of those TBS or TNT, just a random Thursday or something like that when I was a kid, when I probably shouldn't have been watching it, because my parents were fairly conservative and Bond is not particularly conservative, though in some ways he ends up becoming kind of a campy, almost not family friendly, but in a weird way, like families are more okay with him as a spy who seduces women than maybe other.
Yes.
Anyway,
yeah, he's no James Bond Jr.
Yeah. The first film that comes to my mind though is Goldfinger, and I think that was on TV, and I can remember the whole scene where Goldfinger has Bond strapped to the table, and he's got the laser, and do you expect me to talk? And that whole thing. No, I expect you to die. And then probably the second film that is more influential, because that's just kind of like a, you know, very early memory, was GoldenEye. And when the video game came out around the same time for Nintendo 64 when I was a kid, and I remember playing GoldenEye with friends for hours, and then we would watch the film, and then we'd go back to playing the game, and that kind of opened the door to a lot of other Bond films, because there were characters in that video game that were from the other films, and had to go try to watch these movies to understand what exactly, you know, who is Jaws and who is Oddjob, and why is there a golden gun that I can use? And
where is this complex, and why am I so good at killing people?
Yeah.
So what would you say, like, if you had to guess, what age was your probably first experience? That probably TBS or TNT?
Gosh, early elementary school, but not like early, probably eight, I'd say eight or nine, something like that.
All right. So, Mark, what was your first memories of Bond?
Well, I mean, I think it's a very similar situation. I think you see on TV the Dr. No's and the Goldfingers and Sean Connery and a lot of the Roger Moore. I feel like the Roger Moore films are so bad. like comparatively now, that like you're just gonna see them on TV now because they're just so cheap to get and to put on, you know, some of the ancillary channels out in the deep reaches of cable. I feel like it's always been that way, but yeah, I feel like I have a similar being a kid. You know, I was pretty much a TV kid, and you know, I know for a fact I had the same kind of interaction with seeing James Bond, you know, on some channel. but I think our generation's experience with Bond is Goldeneye, you know, yeah. The video game, Pierce Brosnan film. Because
this would be the, and when you say our generation, all of us are the right around 30,
yeah,
plus or minus,
yeah, kind of. Somewhere around there, yeah. Mm-hmm. Because of the video game, but also because like there was a lull in, you know, making James Bond films because of, like, I think it was the writer's strike or whatever at the time. The film before Goldeneye was, I think, License to Kill. It was whatever Timothy Dalton one was before the Pierce Brosnan one, which I think is License to Kill. The first one was Living Daylight. The second one was License to Kill. And I think it was 1987 to 1995. So for us, 1987, I was 2 years old. So 1995, you know, I was 10 years old.
Of an age that you could find it flipping to the TV.
Right. Well, I mean, Goldeneye, I could technically go see, I guess, if my parents took me. I didn't see it in the theater, but I remember, you know, walking the halls of Blockbuster Video.
What is this you speak of?
Yeah. And you know, and renting the VHS off.
It's supposed to be where they keep the Ark of the Covenant.
So I was probably 11 when I saw Goldeneye, I think. Mm-hmm. So, and then you know, yes, I played the video game with my budddies for hours and hours and hours and hours. So you know, that was basically a very similar experience as, you know, I think most people
of our age. Do you remember if you saw Goldeneye before you played the video game?
I don't know. I think I did.
Because what you guys are describing is, I would say, very similar to me. You know, we didn't grow up in, you know, the 80s and the 70s, so Bond wasn't really a thing still when I was younger. And I don't really think it was a very prominent thing when we were younger until Goldeneye comes out. And it's funny, I am pretty confident that I clocked these hours and hours and hours that we're all talking about before I even saw the actual movie Goldeneye.
Right. I'm pretty sure I saw the movie first. I'm pretty sure. Because I remember playing the video game and knowing everything about all the situations and the characters. And
I think I distinctly remember watching the movie and being like, oh, I know what's going to happen.
I didn't. Because I didn't have a Nintendo 64 when I was a kid. My friends had Nintendo 64s. I had a PlayStation. So, you know.
Same boat. Your parents must not have loved you guys. Because I had both. What?
Yeah.
Actually, that was, yeah.
Dang.
That's a different story. That's what happens when you have a brother and you're both into video games and your parents like to dote upon you at Christmas. Yeah. Though they did not make enough money to really have, have doted on us as much as they did.
I mean, I don't feel bad. I had the PlayStation. I had I had the superior machine.
Did you? Anyway, you didn't have Mario Kart 64, thus your argument is invalid. Well, you didn't have Goldeneye, Perfect Dark, or Mario Kart 64.
That's true.
You've already lost.
Smash Brothers. Right. Smash Brothers. Anyway.
Smash button.
Yeah,
I never got into Smash Brothers.
Man, I love it.
Okay, so I like what you've already kind of couched this with, because you've already talked about how there were different Bonds.
Mm-hmm.
They obviously brought a lot to the table in very different ways. Some were campy, some were kind of sleek for our generation, some were sleek for previous generations.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of, you know, misogyny and kind of sleeping around, maybe adult themes, and then it kind of goes back to, I think you said like family friendly, but not family friendly.
Yeah, I'm not sure how to describe it, because it's somehow accessible, but it's a very adult story, and yet there are, you know, these ridiculous contraptions that Bond has, and these hilarious jokes that, and by hilarious, I mean I'm doing a little hand air quotes right now. You can't hear that in a podcast. Yeah. But
oh, I can hear the wind off the quotes. That's how emphatic they are.
Just thinking of Roger Moore's lines that and you expect them, right? Like you're you're looking forward to
over
these
the, over the top villains.
Yeah,
that have wacky names, you know. Like cartoon villains, basically.
Yeah, cartoonish might be a good way, and that seems accessible to children. And maybe that's why my parents, despite all their conservative tastes when it comes to films, were okay with me watching the Bond films. Because it wasn't just Goldfinger. After that, and then watching GoldenEye, I got into it a little bit. And I, especially in middle school, you know, this was I wasn't a particularly cool kid or athletic kid or anything like that. And so watching some sort of action hero on the big screen or on my really at home on my TV. But I remember seeing Tomorrow Never Dies in theaters when I was a kid. And for whatever reason, my parents let me see that. And and it wasn't particularly good now that I look back at it. But when I was a kid, it was, you know, spies and international travel and these crazy gadgets and huge explosions.
But I'm sure your parents after the movie sat down with you and said, let's have a conversation about the themes and theologies of this film and really explore this stuff. And let's not just view it as entertainment. Yeah. And that's when young Joel knew that he would grow up to be a Christian critic.
Absolutely. It's pretty much the exact opposite of that. It was like, movies are bad, don't watch them. Except for these ones, which we won't explain why we're letting you watch them. And so realizing at some point, maybe I should start thinking deeper about why I'm actually choosing to view these films and why they're so appealing to me, or not appealing. So it was, I think I have a bit of a history with James Bond, and he and I have a love-hate relationship in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I feel like we've really made a breakthrough here, Joel. We'll be sending you a bill. I'm not cheap, and that's great. So
this has been very, very therapeutic and eye-opening for me.
Well, I like that, like you said, I like that we've talked about almost, I don't want to call it an evolution of Bond, because I don't ever think it was trying to evolve into a more perfect unit. It was just changing for generations. So if anything, it was a chameleon, if I had to describe it. And we, you know, we grew up in a GoldenEye kind of forward age, but the generation slightly behind us, and one that we're still getting to enjoy the fruits of to certain degrees, is this Daniel Craig post 9/11, very stoic. What was someone described Daniel Craig really great recently? Like the frowny faced Daniel Craig look or whatever, Bond look. They said it probably much more eloquently than that, but you know, so we get another skin hue of this Bond chameleon with especially now Spectre, but Casino Royale, Quantum of Solace, Skyfall, and you have Sam Mendes in this. And like I said, this new feel, Daniel Craig, kind of curmudgeon-y, stoic, no emotions, a little bit rapey maybe, kind of Bond that is just, he's tough. Mm-hmm. Like, he's not funny. Mm-hmm. He's not, you know, he's not cartoony in any way. He's just tough. And so the series has progressed, and we've gotten to the point where we get Spectre. And that, you know, that kind of brings us to what we're talking about tonight. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, kind of caging this conversation with the fact that Bond has taken on so many iterations. When I looked at Spectre, I've heard from all kinds of people about this film specifically. And their opinions about Daniel Craig. So there was no consensus that I saw. And it seemed like everyone wanted this film, especially after Skyfall, to be something different. In fact, there was this phrase that people kept throwing around, which, air quotes, a Bond film. And some people told me this is the classic, or they'd say this is the quintessential Bond film. While others were like, this is very far removed from what makes a classic Bond film. And, you know, it took a couple interactions before I realized that everyone kept saying this phrase in some iteration, except there were people using the phrase to argue completely different sides of the spectrum. And it made me realize that as someone who has not historically been a huge Bond fan, I don't know what it means. So I ask you guys, and Joel, you first, because you're on Skype.
Sure.
Did you enjoy Spectre? What makes up a classic Bond film? And is Spectre a classic Bond film?
I think I would say I had mixed feelings when it comes to Spectre. And there are elements of the film that I really found enjoyable and entertaining. And there are a lot of problems that I had with the film and issues that kept coming up, even in my mind as I'm watching it, just questioning, why is this happening? Or what's going on there? And yet at the end, when I walked out of the theater, I have to admit that I was entertained, and it was, it certainly wasn't boring in any sense, and it kept me engaged. Now, is it a classic Bond film, and what does that mean? When I think of a classic Bond film, and kind of the thread that weaves its way through all the different iterations of Bond, there's this, it's the one heroic figure who is kind of him against some sort of enormous foe that has a ridiculous plot or scheme to take over the world or destroy the world or steal a bunch of gold or do something that's just quite over the top. And yet he can do that. He's this singular figure. He's this individual who is smart. He is capable. He is good looking. He can take down bad guys. He can fly planes or any kind of vehicle that you can possibly imagine. He can do that. And he can do that with this confidence that is almost superhuman. Like, he doesn't seem to have a sense of doubt in himself. He doesn't seem to ever wonder if he's making a poor decision. Questions of morality and ethics really aren't the issue. He's just got to stop the bad guys, and he'll do whatever it takes. And there are brief moments of regret in a couple of key films, like Honor, Majesty, Secret Service, and in Casino Royale, the new one. And the Daniel Craig films are a little bit more willing to dive into Bond's emotional side. Mm-hmm. But when I think of the classic Bond film, I think in many ways it does fit that kind of mold or parameter. And maybe it's interesting that it's even considered its own genre, like we can talk about it, or a subgenre of the action film, that you could say this is a Bond film and here are the elements that it has. Usually has some sort of wacky gadgets. There's got to be a car chase. There's a final showdown in some sort of huge hideout or, you know, this exotic location that Bond finds himself taken to. There's a Bond girl, or many Bond girls, not Bond women, interestingly. They're always called Bond girls, and Bond seduces them, again, completely confident in his abilities to seduce any woman, and always successful. The rate at which these Bond girls die is pretty high. So that's not good for them, I guess. But usually at the end, he ends up with one of them until the next film. And then he's back to being the lone spy against the world. So in that sense, I think Spectre, there's a lot of elements that are classic Bond elements. The one thing that doesn't seem to fit with that, in my opinion, is that it kind of starts to remove by the end of the film that sense that he is on his own and his sense of confidence. So Bond is not particularly confident in every arena in this film, and he's not always on his own. Like, there are a lot of times where he's really got to rely on others, and it becomes more of a team effort. And I can think of some particular scenes in the final acts that are very much Bond and his crew doing their thing. So that seemed a little bit off, some of those classic elements. But overall, I would say it hits all those notes that I mentioned before.
Hmm. So, yeah, I would say a lot of that strikes me as true, but I want to give Mark a shot as well.
Okay. I think I'm probably more the Pure Bond fan here. I don't know about Joel, but I know, Mikey, you're asking these questions because you're not necessarily like, I'm a Bond fan, you know?
Yeah. I watch him.
I feel like I am more, maybe, but, I mean, I haven't, like, seen every Bond. I'm not that kind of Bond fan. But I wanted to kind of preface that because I think a little bit of the franchise of what a Bond film is kind of in the eye of the beholder. I liked Spectre a mm-hmm. lot. I have problems with it as a film. I have, you know, wishes for certain parts that, you know, could have been better and, mm-hmm. and certain decisions that they made and that kind of thing. excuse me. But overall, I think I liked it, but I know it's not perfect. And I think that's part of what makes you a Bond fan. And is knowing that a Bond film is not going to be perfect, I think, is one thing that's part of what's a Bond film.
Classic Bond.
It's classic Bond.
Kind of terrible.
Which is why Casino Royale amazed me, because I thought it was as perfect as a Bond film can get. Everybody points to Skyfall as the best Bond film now, and I think that's the popular opinion. I disagree with that. I think Skyfall had a lot of the same problems that Spectre has in some of the approaches and campiness, but as a film, not just a James Bond movie, but in terms of film, I think Skyfall is the best film in terms of, like, just as a cohesive, coherent, beautiful, cinematic, thematic kind of thing. But I think Casino Royale, in my opinion, is the best Bond film. And what a Bond film is to me, and I think in a general sense, what you can apply to the terminology Bond film, is all those things that Joel's mentioning, kind of like, but there's specific things that you look for in this franchise that I think you look for from a lot of other franchises. What makes a Die Hard movie? What makes a Fast and Furious movie? What makes, you know, whatever the franchise you want to pick, what makes a Lord of the Rings movie, mm-hmm. anything, whatever that it may be. excuse me. I got a little bit of a cough, if that's not...
Do you? I didn't notice.
So you're going to have to just put up with that. I apologize. But so I think it's just just distinctions that filmmaking choices... Huh? Okay, I'm getting there. It's filmmaking choices that were made back in the 60s, or even in the books by Ian Fleming, that have been carried out through... And you have to understand, you might have like 5 Die Hard movies, but you have 24 James Bond movies. So we have a long history to know what's going to always and should always be if you're making a classic Bond film, such as the cartoonish villain with the kind of... There's something... They'll take a villain and they'll just kind of... It's got an odd name or an odd quirk about him, something that's a little bit off from normal life. You know, you've got James Bond out on his own. Joel did a good job of describing kind of the hero mentality of James Bond and how that kind of works. I think you have quirky one-liners, gadgets, that kind of thing. I don't think it's too you know, complex. I think it's pretty straightforward what you you look for in a James Bond movie. So I don't know if that answers your question.
It's just kinda, does Spectre do that?
Oh, I think Spectre does do that because they bring back some of the elements that were missing from the Craig Bond movies that were always present in pretty much every Bond film before him. You know, they bring back in Q Branch and the gadgets. They're a little more present. Actually, they're way more present than any other Daniel Craig Bond movie. And I think, I don't know if that's the goal of Spectre. I think I see a very specific progression in terms of what the producers were trying to do with the Daniel Craig movies, because Casino Royale very much forcefully throws out the James Bond formula, mm-hmm. right? It very much takes it and says, blatantly says, we're not doing this. Like, that's part of the movie. Like, when he orders, you know, a martini and the guy's like, do you want to shake it or stir it? He says, do I look like I give a damn? You know?
Yeah.
that's very like saying, that old formula, we don't want it right now.
Yeah.
And so I think that was that movie. Then Quantum of Solace was just kind of ignoring the formula. It didn't... I mean, A lot of people have a lot of problems with Quantum of Solace. I love Quantum of Solace. I think it's a very good James Bond movie, but a lot of people don't like it, and we could get into that if you want.
Nope.
Nope.
No, not at all. But I think Quantum of Solace just says, we're going to try this vein that we're in right now and just make a movie. Skyfall starts to lean towards that a little bit more. Skyfall is more like, let's make a great film. And it happens to be about James Bond. This one is finally like, all right, let's embrace all that again and see how it works. So it seems like there's four very different approaches to the James Bond movies that Daniel Craig is in terms of the you know, the universe and the quirks and everything that you see in a typical Bond movie.
And so, to your point, this is why we in Spectre would see Daniel Craig ordering a martini shaken, not stirred, specifically right. after Correct. Having antithetically done that.
I think they very specifically went into Spectre saying, we're going to go back and embrace some of that stuff in the way that James Bond as Daniel Craig can. And I think they very specifically were like, let's see how it works. And I mean, I think it's obvious.
Yeah. You know? Well, so I guess my problem with Spectre, and I don't want to, I guess, launch a volley of full-on hatred, because besides the fact that I thought it was a little long, well, it's a lot long.
Yeah, it's long.
I did feel like I was sitting there for a very long time.
Yeah.
And it kind of fell into one of those spy trappings of it tried to be so complicated. I'm not sure why anything mattered in the end.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't really care about Bond at the end of this movie mm-hmm. or at the beginning of this movie or anywhere in the middle.
Well, I think that's a misstep in their approach to this film in leaning on the history of Daniel Craig's James Bond.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of James Bond films don't really focus on James Bond as a person, as an identity, as a character.
Or as a symbol?
What?
Like more as a symbol, though?
Yeah, they just kind of let him, okay, this is James Bond. So James Bond's going to do the things that James Bond always does. Which, you know, doesn't necessarily make good films, but it makes good James Bond movies. You know, like, especially all the Pierce Brosnan ones, they didn't really get into that at all.
Yeah, that's, and maybe Mark, what I'm hearing you say, too, is that there is this clear progression from Casino Royale to Spectre, where Bond's character is actually, he's a character. Like, and he grows, and he mm-hmm. changes, and he's affected. Casino Royale is, like, supposed to be kind of the origin story, right? You know, the very beginning of when he's getting into the 00 program, and now Spectre is kind of when he's arrived, and he's got more confidence, and he's got more skills, and the Q program is there, and even that opening, the very first shot where he, you know, walks across the screen and shoots the camera and the blood, and it all mm-hmm. fades. That wasn't present in the first three Craig films, and here it is. It's kind of like, ah, this is what we've been waiting for. He's arrived. He's been getting there. He's kind of like teenager Bond or something growing up, and now he's all grown up and off on his own, so I can totally resonate with that.
That was one of the great elements about Casino Royale is that they actually incorporated that shot, that typical turnaround and shoot shot, into like his first kill. You know, like that was part of the very beginning of the movie, and it felt necessary. This one felt frivolous. Necessary. It felt necessary in Casino Royale, whereas here they're just like, oh well, James Bond, this is what he does.
Okay, so I'll kind of lean on both of you guys to refresh my memory. I feel like some of the older Bond movies, and when I say older, I mean basically mean before Daniel Craig, the opening credits, I thought were kind of very sexual in nature or very not even symbolic, but very image heavy and having nothing really to do with the film. And I don't remember that in like Casino Royale, Quantum. Were they there too?
Very much.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm a James Bond film fan, but I hate the James Bond credits.
Yeah, I was watching the opening credit.
I never like them.
And Laura just looked at me, and she was like, "What is happening? Why is
that is a James Bond staple?
Okay, because that's terrible.
Adopted and kept for the current modern James Bond.
That was
Casino Royale is really long. Like, because they always play the entire song.
Oh, yeah.
And the entire song. Okay.
They show so all of the credits too, so it's yeah. this very long opening sequence for all of them.
So we do a quick poll. This is a Real World Theology official poll. There's three of us, so there won't be a tie. Mm-hmm. Spectre theme song, terrible or the worst ever?
The worst ever.
The worst ever.
I absolutely despise it.
Joel,
I I'm trying to think if it is the worst ever, but I'm like mentally going back through all the songs that I'm familiar with, but I would say off the top of my head right now, it is the worst ever. Like
the worst ever.
It doesn't even say the word Spectre. Like it doesn't have anything to do with the film whatsoever. I don't get it. I actually don't understand it at all.
I don't dislike Sam Smith. I don't necessarily listen to him. I mean, but I don't dislike him.
Mm-hmm.
Wrong choice. Mm. I hate it.
Hate it.
I hate this. I hate this song.
What was it?
Best Bond song. Joel.
Oh man, the best Bond song.
Easy.
Well,
easy,
Adele's right? Adele has a yeah. She's pretty good. Oh gosh, what is it called? I can sing it.
We'll stop the podcast. I'll the entire song.
Yeah, there you go. I was about to say, I'm about to drop the gauntlet. The best Bond song is Live and Let Die.
Live and Let
Paul McCartney. Live and Let Die. Live and Let Die. Anyway.
So
great song.
My favorite Bond song is, oddly enough, as far as I know, never actually been used in a Bond film. But I believe it's just called James Bond theme. But it's by Moby, and it was on one of his albums that I had. And it's, like, seriously one of the coolest songs that I've ever heard. And it's just the James Bond theme. And it has that quote that Joel was saying earlier. It's like, you expect me to talk? No, Mr. Bond. Yeah. I expect you to die. And it's just, like, right in the middle of it. It's like, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Boom, ding, ding. You know, just, I love it. I used to play it all the time while I was playing Goldeneye.
That's awesome.
I had my own theme music because it was so good. But
hey, I was prepared for this question, so I actually prepared and like
the theme song thing?
And listened to songs and like
I didn't
picked
tell
out
you about,
ones that
I didn't
were
tell
good.
You I was going to ask that question.
Well, I didn't think I didn't know if you were or not. I just thought I thought it was inevitable. So much so that I was going to bring it up anyway.
I was like, is there anything else that really touched your soul, Mark? I don't know, but I thought the song was crap. Well, okay, so I round out kind of what my problem was with the film by wanting to almost play a game, but I couldn't think of a way to do this where it wasn't obvious what
kind
I was doing.
Kind of like a James Bond villain. Let's play a game.
Let's play a game. There's only one answer. No, okay, that's a game. I'm just going to talk. Okay, let me just tell you my plan. Scratch the game.
Yeah.
So I'll call this, and I'm pretty proud of myself for this. So I'm leading with my pride. Who did it better, MI5 or MI6?
Yeah, I know what he's asking. Really, what do you think he's asking, Joel?
Oh, Joel should know. I just realized that thing I was telling you about,
yeah,
was because I read Joel's review.
Yeah,
Letterboxd.
Well, I think we are going to share the same opinion. But go ahead, Joel.
Who did it better, MI5 or MI6?
Yeah.
No,
are you not with me, Joel?
I don't think I'm tracking. And maybe this is... I'm just having, like, my brain is overwhelmed by your nefarious plot right now.
I will rephrase. Who did the better plot line about government surveillance, MI5 or MI6? And by MI5, of course, MI6 we mean James Bond. MI5 we mean Mission Impossible.
Oh, I didn't know if it was Mission Impossible or Captain America 2. Like... aren't those all the same plots? Isn't that
it is basically the same plot.
No,
yeah,
I liked MI Mission Impossible better.
Yeah. MI Mission Impossible. Yeah.
The Rogue Nation one.
The Rogue Nation, yes.
And maybe that was part of my struggle in the film too, is I was like, oh, this was in Mission Impossible, but better. And more fun.
Yeah.
Anyway. So just in case someone has not... Well, okay, because like I said, I think I gravitated towards... And I'm pretty sure this is your Letterboxd review that you did. Again, plug for Letterboxd, which does not sponsor anything, but we all use it because we're cinephiles. Go and look at Joel's, you know, quick Letterboxd review of Spectre. And if you would, Joel, I'm stalling so you can pull it up just in case you don't remember off the top of your head.
Yeah.
Like, when I left the theater, I kept thinking something wasn't right about this. Something didn't feel right. Something didn't feel right. And I was like, I feel like I've seen this before. I feel like I've seen this before. Was it just that I couldn't remember what happened in Skyfall or Quantum Solace, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
Oh, that's wild, because I remember texting you before you saw the movie mm-hmm. and saying, you'll see the similarities in Mission Impossible.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I did.
Totally. Okay, well, I forgot. Laura said something. I don't listen to you. I listen to my wife.
There you go.
So
that's probably a good
hashtag
plan.
Winning.
Yeah.
So she said something like, didn't we see this movie earlier this year? I credit Laura with all my great ideas.
There you go.
That's why I can't have her on the podcast all the time, because then everyone realizes that none of my good ideas are for me, and thus I'm co-opting them.
It's a bold strategy, Cud. Let's see how it pays off.
It pays off. It's like a dodgeball reference in one thing.
That's right.
Always. So I basically was like, oh, that's right, and I started kind of going on the list, and I did not do near as great a job as you did, Joel. So if you would, I mean, hopefully I've stalled long enough.
Yeah, no, I've...
Can you just kind of, like, just hit the highlights, man? Just how does Spectre mirror what we just saw, like, what was it, 3 months ago?
Yeah.
In Rogue Nation.
So Ethan Hunt is James Bond. Same guys, basically. It's the, you know, he's the reckless spy. He's going to stop at nothing. He's going to catch the terrorist behind the big plot. He's confident in himself. He knows what he wants. He's been around the block a number of times. So, and he's more adept at a quick, snarky remark in this film than he has been in previous films. So, you know, same guy. Then you got the capable yet delicate heroine, Ilsa Faust or Madeleine Swann. They got a complicated past. They just want to find freedom from that past. Not sure how to do that. Get wrapped up in the... a bit of an attraction to that main spy. And actually what was interesting too is, and I can't quite remember how to pronounce her name, but Léa Seydoux, who is in Spectre as this femme fatale, was also in the last Mission Impossible film. The one previous as
Ghost Protocol.
One of the bad guys. Then you got your British tech guy who can do anything he wants with computers and adds comedy relief, right?
Well,
that's cute. Or Benji.
To be fair, that's in like every action movie now.
I know. And it all started with
James Bond.
Right.
Really.
And so Benji really is just a Q character for Mission Impossible films.
Correct.
And then this one might be a bit controversial, but I think Moneypenny and Luther Stickle. Luther is played by Ving Rhames.
Mm-hmm.
And then Moneypenny, I think, is Naomi Harris. Are the trusted friend, the black sidekick, the BFF, who can bring out a different side of that main protagonist that nobody else quite sees because they just get along so well. And the difference there is obviously that Moneypenny is a woman and Luther is a guy. And so there's a bit more sexual tension with Moneypenny, hopefully. But and then you got your bad guy, right? You got Solomon Lane in Mission Impossible. You got Blofeld, which is not a spoiler at all. Because everybody knew that going into it, if you have any sense of any James Bond film in the past. Mm-hmm. And IMDb actually lists his name as Blofeld, by the way.
Yeah.
It's not even trying to be subtle.
Surprise!
So this is the guy who, you know, has the master plan. And even it's Spectre and the Syndicate. They're actually really similar names. And then you got the government agent bad guy who's it's not a surprise that he's a bad guy. You got the big hulking henchman. You got this is the one that got me the most. So Lauren is a character in Mission Impossible. And then Lucia is a character in Spectre. And both are attractive female characters who are given about 3 minutes of screen time and then never seen again.
check.
And the impetus of the plan, you know, obviously they're both about surveillance, but we're all creating disasters to create fear, to allow, get more control over whatever, you know.
Exactly. Like, so the same, it's essentially the same plan by the terrorists with the same S at the beginning of their name that stands for something.
it literally stands for something.
Yeah. That's one thing that they never got into in this Spectre film, is that Spectre actually is an acronym. It stands for something. But they never explain what that is or why. And I don't know off the top of my head what it means. I know that the last E stands for extortion, which is important.
That's a very cartoony type thing to have in your name if you're a villain.
Yep. We're all about extortion here.
Special executive for... Let's see. Yeah, special executive for counterintelligence, terrorism, revenge, and extortion.
Ah, need some revenge. Revenge and extortion. Like,
who puts that in your name?
Ian Fleming in the 60s or 50s.
Oh, that's so great. So to kind of throw back to the conversation we had earlier, honestly, I watched only one or two Bond films before I started watching the Austin Powers movies, and I did not have to watch any more Bond films to get every single joke.
Oh, even Daniel Craig was like, oh, Mike Myers just messed us up, man. I mean, Austin Powers, the first movie, is just a incredibly smart, perfect send-up of the entire James Bond franchise. I mean, you know, he continues the shtick through the second two movies, but, I mean, he roasts the whole franchise perfectly. And Dr. Evil is Blofeld.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, it's and that's what I think disappointed me most about Spectre, was they used Blofeld. I love throwing back to the 60s. I love throwing back to the original films, you know, the old Aston Martin that appears in Skyfall and in this movie. I think it's wonderful, and I think it's important for these films to kind of maintain, you know, their connection to that era. But then they used Blofeld, and it disappointed me as much as Star Trek Into Darkness using Khan, you know, and flipping the Khan, you know, to Spock, and like trying to make it a modern version. You know, it's just forced, you know, unearned.
Well, so. And when they do it in such a way that it's supposed to be some sort of big reveal, you know, and there's this mystery character that is played by this famous actor, but they're definitely not this, you know, super recognizable villain. And then surprise, it's not a surprise. There's no twist to that. And it's actually more frustrating and takes one out of the story when it's obvious that the filmmakers are trying very hard to feel that twist.
So what do you do as a filmmaker? Is it possible to hide a character like that, or hide a reveal like that in a movie with as much media and
not anymore.
Do you just embrace it and say, hey, Christoph Waltz is in this and he's obviously Blofeld, guys.
Yeah.
It's gonna Blofeld your mind. You know? Just like they fully embrace it, or they're like, no, I don't know why I'm George Lucas.
You kind of sound like Dr. Evil there for a second.
It's definitely not Blofeld.
Yeah. That would be evil.
Ooh, it would be delightfully evil. what do you do? Like, do you just put all your cards on the table and say, like, look, he's in it?
I think they could have pulled the Star Wars, and they almost do this, where Blofeld, you know, I am your father, and that, they could have pulled that off at some point. That would maybe thrown people for a loop if they had already announced that Blofeld was in the film ahead of time. Mm-hmm. But not only do they do the Blofeld surprise, it's Blofeld moment, but also surprise Blofeld, and there's a, you know,
there's
a backstory. Significant backstory that Bond is very aware of throughout the film, until finally, you know, the villain has to give his long spiel, letting us know what his plan was all along. So I'm not sure that you can.
It was me, the author, the author of all your pain. I just think it's so. Christoph Waltz is so weird. He has that, you know, ability to just be that weird, scary. But like, I just felt like it felt so weak in this movie. The author of all your pain. That's just like,
it's the impression episode.
Yes. I just was like, okay.
All right, so we obviously don't have a great answer to that. Storytellers.
What was the question?
So storytellers, you're boned. All right, there's just nothing you can do. Don't try to hide things from the audience unless it's like a Bill Murray cameo in Zombieland. Then you can hide it.
Exactly.
Okay, so I guess my problem is back to the is it, you know, who did it better, MI5 or MI6? Did Mission Impossible see that James Bond was going darker and just say, we're going to keep it fun, or we're going to make a better Bond film? Like, we're basically going to make a better American Bond film than like the British that forgot how to make Bond films. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, because we all really like Rogue Nation, right?
Oh, yeah.
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 So, why, Joel, why did you like Rogue Nation so much more than Spectre?
I think it did embrace like its fun side and its campiness. And while Spectre added some fun elements and tried it, Daniel Craig just doesn't have the charm and charisma in the same way that Tom Cruise does. Like, he's still a very charming, intense, dangerous kind of spy. And Tom Cruise is just kind of, he's risky business, you know, like he's Top Gun. Yeah, like it's hard to necessarily take his stuff seriously when he gets really into it. But it was still thrilling. It was edited well. Rebecca Ferguson was just a wonderful surprise. She added so much to the film and, mm-hmm. you know, stole every scene that she was in. Mm-hmm. And I think that the differences, too, are that the MI films have a team and collaborative element to them, and always have. It's always been about the team, and we have
purposefully team as opposed to Spectre, yeah. which is like falling into team, right?
And even at the end, the team element in that doesn't really come together. Q does a couple things that are helpful, but really it's just them kind of running around, where the team is absolutely necessary. Like, Ethan can't do what he does without his team. So it comes back to this kind of communal versus individualistic mm-hmm. mindset. And I guess I appreciate that more. And when those characters are actually fleshed out a bit, even when they're silly, like Benji, mm-hmm. They're still, I care if Benji is going to get hurt or killed. Where in this film, if somebody tied up M and was threatening to blow him, I'd be like, see you, Rafe. Yeah. I'm sorry, buddy. Like, it's just not there the same way. There's not that chemistry.
Well, I think it's funny. I think I might have a little bit of an opposite opinion about MI5. I don't feel like that they relied on Tom Cruise. I feel like they purposefully did not rely on Tom Cruise. I felt like, you know, Mission Impossible 3... Mission Impossible 4, kind of were still... Tom Cruise is kind of losing his box office draw, and I think they wisely recognize that and lean less in Rogue Nation on the leading man and just let the action just be awesome and fun, and they have a great time with it. And of course, like we're saying, they're more focused on the team in those movies, but James Bond is all about James Bond, and they're leaning all on Daniel Craig to carry this movie. That's and true. And to me, he's really the reason why this movie works. I mean, you know, it's James Bond, you have to have James Bond, but you have to have a good James Bond and somebody who you can kind of lean on in this film, you know, because a lot of James Bond movies are not, like I said, they're not perfect. And so you have to have a guy who's going to carry you through that. And this film badly needs that, you know, it badly needs it. And so he, I think doesn't, you know, there's a lot going around about him not putting his all into the part, kind of phoning it in and kind of being done with James Bond or being tired with the part. And you can kind of tell. And I went in like thinking about that, you know, as I watched the movie, and I really felt like that wasn't true. I felt like he's actually masterfully playing like a tired agent. And I mean, that may or may not be true. I think there are some elements of him being fatigued with the role.
Mm-hmm.
And you can kind of see, I feel like, you know, Sam Mendes, you know, going from Skyfall and saying, they always say, I'm never going to do another James Bond film. And then they end up doing another James Bond film.
Money talks.
I think it's a great team on paper and it worked for Skyfall. I just, I think it didn't work, totally work a second time around. You could kind of see that fraying, but Daniel Craig is not going to go out there and do a bad job acting because it, you know, he's very good at it. So I think he carries this movie, whereas Tom Cruise didn't carry Rogue Nation. Rogue Nation carried Rogue Nation. You know.
Well, so if I'm an audience, general audience person, what is it that I am, what is it that Mission Impossible 5 is giving me compared to what I would be getting from a James Bond film? Like, what big draw is there? Like, if I had to choose between these two, what am I more apt to go see?
There shouldn't be anything different.
There shouldn't?
No. The characters, the scenarios, maybe, the team versus the lone man, the style of the 60s of James Bond versus the kind of modern tech, you know, high color saturation of the Mission Impossible films. But other as far as draw, there really shouldn't be anything different, because when you look at the first two-thirds of Spectre, there the action's just as good and just as amazing and just as big and just as exciting as a lot of the action in Rogue Nation.
Mm-hmm.
I thought Rogue Nation was a little too long, and I thought it lulled. You know, I feel like these movies are very similar. You know, they, especially in terms of setup, obviously we've talked about that. But Mission Impossible films and James Bond films are very similar in that they have all these action sequences. It's all about getting to the action. It's all about what story can we make up to, like, get us from one action sequence to the next?
Huh. Okay. So.
So.
I think you're right when you compare them that way, Mark. And because of that, I'm going to ask Joel the same question in a different way.
Okay.
I hope. So, Joel,
yeah.
You have, I don't know, a random person who is a huge fan of CinemaWorld, and they come up to you and say, Joel, I only got time to watch one film. I'm either going to watch Mission Impossible 5 Rogue Nation, or I'm going to watch, you know, James Bond Spectre. Does your recommendation fall completely on, like, you enjoyed one more and that's why you recommend the film? Or is there something that the film does that you would say, I think you really should watch this one because I think you're going to get something out of it like this, which is a lot more than you're going to get out of this other film because of X, Y, and Z? Like I said, is there something thematically they're getting out of it, or is it mostly just because you think one film's better than the other?
I guess my answer would be a mixture of both, because I genuinely do think that Mission Impossible is the better of the two for being so similar in plot and characters and all those things. But there's some elements that really do stand out. And while Daniel Craig, I agree with Mark, I think Daniel Craig really tries to hold Spectre together. And that's the burden of a James Bond film, is it really centers around the James Bond actor. And if he doesn't do a good job, like, it's not a good film. And even, like, the plots aren't known in James Bond films as being necessarily fantastic. So it's really all down to that one guy, where the Mission Impossible films, especially this latest one, I think seeing Rebecca Ferguson do what she did in this film, and I had not seen her in anything else. I didn't know who she was.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a delight, I think, when you see somebody and you're like, this person, I just watched them become a movie star. Mm-hmm. And just the confidence that she had throughout the film, the way that she did all the action scenes and the scenes that were more character driven and dialogue, and just the team dynamic and the chemistry of Mission Impossible film. The Mission Impossible film was much more interesting to me. And I think more compelling, and it's shorter. It is slightly shorter. They're both a bit overly long,
yeah.
But if you're, you know, looking for time or something like that, you can watch Mission Impossible and find something a little bit sleeker and swifter in that sense. I do think James Bond is more stylish in the sense that he's got the cool cars and he dresses in cool clothes and there's an elegance to it that Mission Impossible feels a bit more scrappy, I guess. And
that's a good point.
Yeah, that's another part of the. That's another thing that makes a James Bond film is very fine things. I mean, he wears a tuxedo.
Very fine things. Well,
you know, I mean, but it's true though. You know, he drives an Aston Martin. He doesn't drive whatever he can find on the side of the road. You know, he drinks martinis. He wears tuxedos.
All of his furniture is made from rich mahogany.
Yeah, James Bond, in a sense, and this is going to sound really simplistic, but he is cool. Like, he is a cool person. He is the he's annoyingly cool in some ways. He's actually like, I don't like you because you're so cool. And everything about you, like, you're athletic and you're smart and, you know all these languages and you could also kill people. And
What do you think makes him cool? What do you say James Bond is cool? What do you mean by that?
He's listening it, man. I want to speak languages. And...
yeah, but...
Well, yeah, but I mean, like...
It's okay, different than, like,
I want to be athletic.
Ethan Hunt in a weird way feels approachable to me. Like, I could actually hang out with him and he wouldn't be,
he you feels like more like down a, your couch.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that might happen. I don't know.
Mark.
Oh man.
Sorry. I'm sorry, Joe.
Where Daniel Craig is cool, both in the sense of he's stylish and fashionable and awesome, but cool also in the sense that he's aloof. He's a bit standoffish and a bit above it all. And so I'm not sure if that's it. That's why I said it's almost annoying. Like, I don't think I would be able to hang out with him. I'd feel almost uncomfortable because I'm not that cool compared to him. Whereas Ethan Hunt and his team, I mean, like, at the end of one of the films, they're like hanging out and having drinks. And it's just kind of they're best buds, where James Bond is not a best bud with anybody.
You're not getting shawarma with James Bond.
Yeah, exactly. I think showing his apartment in this film was actually very revealing of that.
Did you just move in?
Yeah. He's alone.
He's never there.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and that's definitely part of his character, being a loner. But I think, to me, James Bond is cool because of what Daniel Craig brought out of him in Casino Royale. And not because Daniel Craig did it, because that's, to me, the essence of James Bond that I like so much. That's why Casino Royale is my favorite, because it just strips James Bond down to what makes him so cool to me, and that he's going to go in there. He doesn't care how much pain he's going to endure. What you think, you know, if he's outmatched, you know, you got a guy that's just so much bigger than him, or you've got the weapons out the wazoo, he doesn't care. He's gonna win, and he knows he's gonna win just because he's gonna go in there and he's confident enough to keep fighting until he kicks your butt,
because all he does is win.
All I do is win.
That confidence is huge, actually.
Which is completely unrealistic. I mean, really. I mean, you know, James Bond is not realistic. And I think that's what's cool to me about him, is that he's going to go in there and kick. But, and you know, I think it's kind of what I wrote for, you know, the two James Bond films I reviewed leading up to it, just kind of talking about the Bond identity. And I think that coolness factor is, to me, is built into the fact that he is almost invincible, but yet now we kind of have like this fraying, you know, that's what was great. I keep going back to Casino Royale, is that when he got into a big fight, he had scars on his faces. Mm-hmm. Spectre lost that. Skyfall lost that. Quantum of Solace didn't. And that's why I think, like, a lot of people point to Skyfall as like the best James Bond film. I don't like it as much.
I think everyone thinks Casino Royale is the best Bond film.
Well, maybe. I do. In case you couldn't tell.
Everybody, Mark.
Yeah. But anyway, I think to me the coolness factor of James Bond is why I find a lot of heroes cool. You know, John McClane's gonna win, and he's just gonna got that cocky kind of.
Yeah, but he's the everyman. That's why John McClane is cool.
Well,
I mean, okay, in the
first three one, movies, yeah, he's the everyman. Yes.
And the later ones, he's a superhero.
But I think the coolness factor to me is it's just that he's gonna kick your butt, and he doesn't kind of care that you think like the bad guy thinks he might lose. Like there's a similar
character. Do we want to be Bond?
Do we want to be Bond?
In some ways, like probably the darker side of me wants to be Bond, and not like the not healthy side of me. If I'm honest, you know, like to be the kind of guy that can essentially do whatever I want and don't have a sense of, you know, there's not this moral guilt that follows him around. He's not, you know, crying himself to sleep at night after killing all these people or seducing women or crashing cars or all these things. And even his mission, I'm still, it's unclear sometimes, like, is he doing this for himself or is he doing it for his country? And I know he says he's doing it for his country often, but there are moments where you're kind of like, this guy in some ways is
he's not doing it for his country.
Yeah, he just likes to punch people.
Yeah, he's definitely not doing it for his country. He's doing it for himself. That's what makes James Bond intriguing, is that he's helping his country by doing it, but he doesn't live in that kind of apartment because he cares about his country. Yeah. He lives in that kind of apartment because he's never going to be there, because he's going to be out just finding the next mystery to solve.
It's kind of surreal.
Mrs. Bond. Or Miss Bond.
Yeah, apparently. Well, you know, I think to answer your, I'll answer your question. To answer your question,
thank you.
I don't know if I don't want to be like, I don't want to just go and do whatever I want. I would like the ability to, you know, execute whatever I want to do, you know? Like, I think if we had to put him on the table and say, well, you can be James Bond or you can be Ethan Hunt. Which one do you want to be? I think it would be Ethan Hunt, because he's more relatable. He's kind of more down to earth.
But it's not skill; it's luck.
Well, but he's got a lot of skill, and James Bond has a lot of luck. So, I mean, James Bond's all about luck. You know, I mean, it's the same kind of thing. You can have as much skill as you want, but you get into the situations these guys are putting. You get in a plane careening down the side of a mountain in the snow, bursting through houses. You hope that you run through the house instead of stopping and getting ejected and killing yourself.
Well, see, that's where I would probably... assuming that one were to believe in luck, all right? You could have... I think the stuff in... I think they... Because it's sleek, because it's, you know, supposed to be put together, and Bond is, I never feel like what happens in Bond is lucky. Mm-hmm. Nowhere when there's a plane careening down a side of a snow-capped mountain do I feel Bond's ever not in control. Even, you know, he's going through a barn or whatever. He's got the smooth look. He's like, exactly like I drew it up, you know? But in Mission Impossible, we're gonna milk this comparison all day. I see, like, Ethan Hunt being like, oh gosh, oh gosh, oh gosh, oh gosh.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's going to happen. We got a timer. Everything's got a timer. Mm-hmm. And it just happened, like, right before, just because someone happened to walk by at just a certain, you know, everything is framed in Mission Impossible. Like, oh, they came in, whoo, they turned around just in time. Everything in Bond is like, yep, I blew that up because reasons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's definitely like a almost, and I think Alec Baldwin's character in Mission Impossible even addresses that it's all based on luck. He, like, overtly says this. Where in Bond, all the Bond movies probably, but particularly in Spectre, there is a sense of control and a plan, and I do know what's going to happen next. And even I thought of the moment where in the final one of the final moments where Blofeld, you know, has Bond and he has to choose, and there's a building that's about to blow up. That whole elaborate, like, literal walk down memory lane, with the pictures on the walls and the strings, is very elaborate and very cool looking, but it's definitely not accidental. Or like that would have taken. I remember thinking, gosh, that would have taken hours to set up this way, and it's all just going to blow up. Like this is maybe even days to really get all those strings attached the way that they did it. But there's almost a structure aura, Bond has a plan in mind where Ethan Hunt feels like he's improvising. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure which one I do like better. I feel like my real life feels more like improvising. But I think I long for some sense of self-control or the confidence that you're talking about, Mark, where I could feel like I could handle any situation that's thrown my way. And I've already thought about it, and I know that I have the skills to be able to handle that. But I don't know that I'd want to walk through life. Like, Ethan has a moral compass, and Ethan Hunt does seem to care genuinely about the people around him. Bond, all of his relationships essentially are disposable. And that's something that I'm not sure that I would want to emulate in my life.
Well, let's just say that we would all be Hannibal from the A-Team. Because we'd love it when a plane comes together. Well, okay, so I want to switch gears to hit one more thing before we kind of wrap up. And that's that spy movies and thrillers often have, like, this big bad guy threatening the entire world with whatever. And whatever happens to always be whatever seems to be in the public conscious at the time. You know, at one point in history, you know, most Bond movies or most spy movies were about nuclear annihilation.
Cold War.
Yeah, the Cold War. You know, everyone's afraid that someone's getting a nuclear weapon and start a nuclear whatever. Mm-hmm. And, but since 9/11, that's kind of changed a lot. That's, you see a lot of these things about spy movies stopping kind of terrorism. And since there's been the counter to countering terrorism is the accumulation of information or surveillance and the ability that has, Joel, you already pointed out, this is what Captain America 2 was about. This is what Rogue Nation was about.
Mm-hmm.
So are people that scared of their information being out there? Like, is this really a threat, or is this just the best people can do because it's pointing to something else?
I think for maybe an older generation, I think the idea of having your information out is a bit different. And maybe this is I'm an older version of a millennial, so I can, embrace that if, you know, mm-hmm. in this kind of moment, I think I'm less bothered by having my information go public than maybe my parents' generation would be. Mm-hmm. Because there's a fear there for whatever reason of, secrets getting let out or people knowing who I am. And I'm like, I'm on Facebook and Twitter and all the places on the internet. So I don't know. I don't have much to hide, even if I wanted to, at this point, like my information's out there. I think that maybe the fear behind that though, and the information is that information equals control or equals power. And information in the wrong hands, and if everybody has all the information on everybody, or if scary, powerful people who want to do bad things have that information, then the world is in danger. And the mm-hmm. whole Snowden era thing, right, where we don't trust our governments anymore because we're not even sure that they have our best interest in mind, I think that's creating these films where the bad guys are the governments in a lot of ways, or people placed within the government. It's not, you know, the British government versus the bad guys. The bad guys have already infiltrated the government and are part mm-hmm. of that. They are the terrorists. Same thing with the, you know, with Hydra and Marvel. Same thing with the Mission Impossible film we've been talking about so much. So I think it's blurring the lines of who's really the bad guy now, and that is scary, I think, for people.
Well, it's also the unknown. You know, do you want your information out there? Is it bad to have your information out there? I don't know. Is it? You know, and so I think there, you know, the twist of all of that is like, do you know what can really be done with your information? Well, I mean, I don't think anybody really knows at this point. So it can still be used as a bad guy plot. But it's going to, I think it's probably, you know, maybe going to be one of those things where we look back in 20 years and be like, oh, that's what we were afraid of at that point, but now that's not a problem. I mean, I think things are cyclical. They just look a little bit different in each era. So, I mean, I don't know if I kind of buy the whole thing. I mean, it kind of seemed like an easy way to give Blofeld something to do, you know, to be there. Which, you know, the entire Blofeld part of this movie I dislike, right? Even though I like the movie because of the first two thirds, because, you know, like the opening sequence is one of the best sequences in James Bond history, I think, you know, the Day of the Dead parade and all that stuff. Really impressive, a lot of fun. And that's what you go to the James Bond movies for, at least I do.
Mm-hmm.
At least I think James Bond film fans do that. So, you know, this idea about information and it getting stolen, and I think it's starting to fade. You know, we're starting to kind of see that, well, if you're stealing my information, you're stealing the information of billions of other people. And so when you're one of a billion people and all your information's out there, well, what makes me so distinct? You know, I don't know. That's something you can dig in and explore.
Yeah. But. I mean, like, and I always waffle back and forth on this. I do feel that people want to keep their information secret on some level. Everyone has different gates to this. Now, there's the idea that if you're not doing anything wrong, then you don't have anything to hide. But then at the same time, you have anonymous YouTube commenters. You know, the anonymity of the internet gives people a license to do and say the things that they would never do. And if people found out they were the person doing and saying those things, they would open a window to this dark piece of them that people would see. And so this is why I like how it was John Oliver who went and interviewed Edward Snowden on his show.
Mm-hmm.
And Snowden was trying to explain to people how like it's a big deal that people have information. And John Oliver's like, yeah, we don't care, you know. We post everything. We don't care. And it's kind of how I feel most of the time. It is, if I don't want people to know, then I will not put it on Facebook. Or I will not put it on the internet. Or just don't do anything dumb because people probably will be able to find it. Because mm-hmm. that's how the internet works now. Everything's connected. Everything.
Mm-hmm.
But then he goes, and through a rather crude manner, though effective, John Oliver says, well, what would happen if I took this type of picture? Would the government be able to see it? And he's like, yes. And then he goes back and asks citizens again, and they're like, they can do this. And they're like, oh, now I care. Because you can make it something tangible. They can see that they're doing something that they think no one would care about, that lets them see this piece of them, or literally a piece of them, and then they have a stake in the game. And to me, when people use this, if you don't really make it personal, if you use the surveillance piece as a plot device and you don't make it personal,
mm-hmm.
it really does seem like the easiest way to say that the bad guy is doing something
nefarious. Yeah.
But really it's about getting you from action piece to action piece to action piece, which, as we've already mentioned, is probably the point of a movie like Spectre, right, or Rogue Nation,
right,
or Captain America. Even though some of these movies are better objectively than others. So,
well, and it also felt in Spectre that whole, you know, the whole thing was tacked on. I mean, what's Spectre about? Well, it's a James Bond movie. It's about James Bond. Well, what's the James Bond part of this movie? Well, it's about his stepbrother getting revenge on him. You know, so it's more about this personal story between you know, kind of James Bond's opposite and his family member that he once thought was dead, you know, kind of wanting to destroy everything that he's ever loved. And he just happens to do that through, I don't know, let's spin the Hollywood dice. the Hollywood, like, you know,
20-sided die.
Yeah, Wheel of Nefariousness. And find out what we're going to land on is the reason that he's going to do all this. But the story... What?
I kind of want to make one now. You want to make
one? That might be kind of smart. It might go viral. What was that, Joe?
It's like, Joel? Here's an atomic bomb, or there's some sort of killer virus, or...
Yeah.
Or sharks with freaking laser beams on their head.
Or, you know, like in Skyfall, revenge on your former boss. Whatever it is. You know, But I think the real story here is Blofeld and Bond, and they kind of ignore it. I mean, they don't really get to it until he's got, like, for some reason, a needle drilling into his brain.
Or something.
Or something.
I don't know.
And he goes, and at this point, we've wasted so much of the movie, not that the movie is a waste, but we've wasted so much of the movie without talking about it, that now he can't show it, he's got to tell it.
Yeah.
So.
Well, all right. So, there are a number of things that this film begins to touch on, but like some films that we see that are Hollywood blockbusters, they don't really dive deep into any one particular theme. There were lots of reviews that talked about how death was very prominent, but isn't necessarily explored, even though it's symbolic in the film. That there's the idea that we've kind of hit on about, you know, what would make you want to go see a Bond film in the first place, some of the attributes of Bond himself. And so there's definitely some ideas here to explore. But unfortunately, we're about at that time where we need to start wrapping up the show.
Yeah.
So we're going to do that. And then, of course, you know, we can always have conversations on the Real World Theology group or wherever, the comment section. That's what that's for. Hopefully not, like, YouTube comment sections, but very, very non-anonymous. But to do that, we start by maybe lambasting the film just a little bit, kind of talking about our critiques. We obviously all have something that didn't set right with us. So, Joel, if you had to pick, what would be your biggest annoyance or what we call the come on moment about Spectre for you?
I think my biggest frustration is how underutilized some really great actors are, like Christoph Waltz. He's really only in the film just for a few minutes and doesn't really get to do much with the time that he's on screen. And he's played such great villains in the past, and they don't seem to really let him loose. The script just... He was kind of bland. It could have been really anybody there. And so I felt pretty disappointed that he was acting so not villainous. He wasn't scary. He wasn't threatening. He looked really tiny, actually. Maybe Christoph Waltz is a very short man in real life.
Very tiny man.
Yeah. So he just wasn't as threatening as I had hoped.
Mark?
My most come on moment is based on the fact that I felt like the action got lazier and lazier throughout the film gradually. Start off with an amazing sequence. I mean, just one of my favorite sequences. I can't wait to go back and watch multiple times. But the action kind of gets lazier and lazier, and the culmination of that becomes my least favorite part. And the culmination of that is when they're escaping the whatever information compound built into a crater thing that's Blofeld's kind of hub. James Bond basically he shoots a bunch of guys, okay, but then he just shoots something and like the entire thing just blows up. Like hardcore blows up like they were on a gas mine or like there's this, you know, gas line. Why would a place that you keep a bunch of computers and a bunch of servers to keep a bunch of information on people have something that would blow up that enormously? Because, I mean, it blows up. It's not just like, things don't just explode. It completely gets annihilated.
I think that actually is like a record. Like, it set a Guinness World Record for the largest explosion on screen or something. I was reading in an article somewhere that explosion... They really blew that up, and it was really that big.
They just blew it up.
That makes me hate it so much more. Because it's so pointless. Like, he shoots a bunch of guys in typical James Bond fashion. They're shooting right at him with, you know, fully automatic weapons, and they don't hit him. And he that's fine. Okay, I'm James Bond that does that. But they just wanted to blow something up, and so they blew up this information center. He just, like, shoots a couple things, and it's just like, whoosh, you know. I found it was lazy and annoying.
Well, to that point, I guess I've never been in war, so I don't know how possible this is.
I mean, I suppose he built this information center on a gas line, I guess.
But later in the film, I think that plays itself out, if you can believe it, more ridiculously, because from hundreds of yards away,
yeah,
he shoots down a helicopter with a pistol.
That's what I'm saying. It keeps getting lazier. So,
I mean, this wasn't like he pulled out like a Jack Nicholson Batman revolver and shoots down the the Batwing. This is like his little P-38 or whatever it is.
Yeah.
I'm like,
I don't think that was the culmination of the laziness, simply because I'm pretty sure if you shoot a pistol, even if you're far away, if you shoot bullets at a helicopter, it's probably not a good thing.
Okay, but, okay. Hundreds of yards away with a handgun on a moving target. I know he's
from
good.
A moving place because you're on a boat. Yeah.
I was like, come
in the dark.
I was like, come on.
And what's so disappointing about it is, again, and I'm always going to use this from now on because I think it's the perfect Bond film, Casino Royale.
What?
All of the action in that movie is earned and necessary. I mean, it feels very like you're in the situation. Yep. You've got to, and it's very raw. Mm-hmm. They're hands-on. So, and this movie just kind of got more to the like, shoot it down.
Yeah, like we haven't had a helicopter blow up yet. Oh, wait. No, it did.
Yeah.
Well, we've run out of vehicles. So this is what we're going to do with the final sequence.
And what Blofeld's just like sitting there in the helicopter and just like, oh. What's going on?
It's actually one of the most anticlimactic endings, too. Like, they go out, he's on the bridge. Yeah. Are we allowed to talk about that, spoiler-wise?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Sure. So, okay, I mean, so. Especially having gone this long without, like, really spoiling anything, I think you've earned it, Joel.
Okay, so this final moment, and they walk out, they have this conversation, he chooses not to shoot Blofeld, which we know that's going to happen because there's nothing really that surprising in this film. And Christoph Waltz just kind of stares at him, like with this awkward little grin. There's no, snarky comment. There's no, I'll get you next time. He's just kind of awkwardly looking at him. And then that's it. Like he just, it actually felt really awkward. Like if I was in that conversation and somebody's just staring at me, I'd be like, somebody say something. Somebody take him away.
Somebody say something.
Blofeld just got weird on us at the end, so I don't know. I don't know why they ended it that way.
For some reason, all I'm picturing is all these things we wish or don't understand how Christoph or Blofeld basically was responding there in the end is Christoph Waltz voicing all that in my brain and Mark's Christoph Waltz voice right now.
The author of all your pain.
Oh, what? Who's shooting at me? This is so crazy. I can't do it, Christoph Waltz.
You sound like Mike Myers in Coffee Talk, Like, do you guys know that?
Talk amongst yourselves.
Talk amongst yourselves.
That's Christoph.
He is neither Blofeld nor Christoph Waltz.
What? Because what is Christoph Waltz's accent? I mean, it's not really German. It is German, but it's like a, I don't know. He just kind of has his own take on it. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway,
whatever. I don't know Christoph Waltz is a cultural background.
It's artsy German.
Or maybe artsy German.
Yeah. I don't know. Well, I'll say these two things from a come on moment real quick. And obviously both of them kind of tie in together because apparently I don't like my heroes being misogynist. Whew, weird. one had less to do with, I guess, Bond and more about unearned moments in the film. And that was when I actually rolled my eyes and almost got physically angry because of how dumb it was. And that's when Madeline Swan leans in during kind of like the torture scene and is like, I love you. I'm like, why? Give me one piece of a reason, not even a whole reason, just a piece of a reason why you would say that you love this man. Tell me that you're like, if she leans in and says, I want to have pointless sexual interactions with you in the future because you've got a hot body. Like, I would understand that. but like, I love you. I'm like, seriously. Like, that made no sense. To the point where I was trying to rationalize it. Like, oh, she's trying to throw Blofeld off and give a reason for her to hang out closer to Bond for longer. And it was like, nope, they're really trying to say
that. I think all of this doesn't work. At all, I think the what they were reaching for as a film was to harken back to what Daniel Craig's Bond lost in Casino Royale.
Yeah.
He loved her, and he lost her, and she kind of pushed him away to, you know, whatever, sacrifice herself. Whereas in this one, he's kind of sacrificing himself for her, and she's, you know, kind of fulfilling that. It don't work,
but
I think that's what they were reaching for. That's my best guess.
That's the thing. We should not have to...
Because this film this film is all about wrapping up the previous three films. Yeah.
Well, okay, so I said I was going to do this fast, and obviously I didn't because it was so annoying to me. But the other thing is, it's creepy to think about it. When Bond is creepily seducing Lucia, it's just so uncomfortable and... Maybe I just have never been seduced by Bond before, and I don't understand the rules. But like, if I see a dude pressing parts of his body up against a recent widow after just murdering two people,
and her husband,
like I'm trying to like I said, maybe I'm not a spy. Maybe I don't get it. Maybe I'm not an international heiress to a bad guy fortune or something, and I don't know what turns people on. But nothing about that scenario says, let's get Jiggy up against this glass. Nothing. And I'm just like, this is creepy. Bond's kind of creepy.
Yeah.
Bond needs to not be creepy. So, and again, like I said, this adds to the I wasn't with Daniel Craig at the beginning of the film, I wasn't with him at the end of the film, and any of those parts in between those two moments. So, yeah, so it kind of wasn't doing it for me. But, as always, we end on a more positive note. So, Joel, what was your favorite part of this film?
Well, I don't want to steal it from Mark because the opening sequence was pretty phenomenal. So I'm going to try and think of something else that I really found well done. And I think one action sequence that I did enjoy and found to be kind of fun was when Bond is in his car and Mr. Hinks, played by Dave Bautista, is chasing him, and they're through the streets of Rome. And Bond keeps trying all of his little gadgets on his car, and they don't work the way that he wants. That was a genuinely fun moment and a good car chase scene. Rome is a great city to be able to do something like that, and the two cars that they had were just really cool and stylish as well. Mm-hmm. So I liked that scene. I felt like, oh, that was really fun, and I was engaged that entire time. I like that he trashed the car at the end. Just that whole sequence was good.
It's parked at the bottom of the river.
Yeah, exactly.
What a jerk move.
Yeah, the cars are impossibly cool. I mean, that's another thing why I watch James Bond movies and enjoy them thoroughly, just because you're always going to see great cars getting blown up.
It's a Lambo. It's my Lambo.
Yeah, I mean, my favorite part's the opening sequence, simply because it's so well done. It's that one long take to open the film. It just sets off this tone of urgency and energy. I just thoroughly love the look of Bond in that skull mask. You know, it could have been campy and quirky and funny, but I actually thought it was kind of awesome. You know, like, just, I don't know, because I've always liked Daniel Craig's Bond simply because of the, like, I'll kill you with my finger if you mess with me kind of look in his eyes, you know, that steely-eyed F.U. glare, you know? and so I thought that was a great way to capture that in a fantastical way, was that mask. I really think if I had to pinpoint one specific thing, it's that look. It's that mask that he had on. But it's also a great frame, I think, for the movie, even though the movie is uneven and doesn't work in the end. Necessarily, but it's a great frame that starts with the quotation, you know, the dead are alive and you're in the Dia de los Muertos. It's just a beautiful way to start the film, and I love that entire action sequence a lot.
So mine too. So you got the Joel saved the thunder for you that you could use to steal mine.
Yeah.
See how it rolled naturally. Obviously. But no, I think about the only piece of this film that I can say that I really enjoyed was the opening sequence. I mean, there were bits and pieces here and there, but I really enjoyed the opening sequence before that song started playing, mm-hmm. the song that shall not be named because we've already talked about it. And it's not necessarily for like a specific look. It's because I thought that it was the Bond film that I was hoping that I would get. And it captured a couple pieces. Mm-hmm. And let's see if I can kind of narrow those down. There's the him being cool. There's the he's obviously got a lady that's very interested in him, but it's kind of a cover. Mm-hmm. I mean, not completely a cover because it's Bond, but it kind of works. And he's like, I'll be back. And he goes and does this thing. He's doing something that we as an audience don't really understand all the pieces of it, but I'm very intrigued. Mm-hmm. There's great action. I didn't necessarily think it was completely necessary to have the one long shot, though technically it was really cool. But when the building crashes and he lands on the sofa, I said, okay, cool. There's going to be some of those... we realize we're not taking ourselves maybe quite so seriously this film.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a little funny, which did not happen in the rest of the film. And then the action sequence that we got in the helicopter fight and stuff, that was that Bond confidence, really cool, very, very well, I thought, filmed, pretty easy to follow action sequence that ended with something that was pretty intense. And for the most part, it was the only piece of the film where I was metaphorically on the edge of my seat. Not quite literally on the edge of my seat, but I was, you know, sitting forward being like, oh, what's going to happen next? What's going to happen next? And then after the song, I just didn't really feel like that for the rest of the film. I either didn't understand what was going on or I didn't care for the most part, except for when there was action sequences. And I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. But still nothing really topped that first one. Because like I said, I think it promised... this idea that I didn't get with the rest of the film. So it was my favorite, but it kind of points to sadness or some disappointment that I have with the rest of the film. Yeah. But, you know, all is not lost. It wasn't, you know, like I said, I don't think it was a terrible movie. I think I came to the conclusion after the film, and I think I texted you, Mark, after I got out of the theater and said something to the effect of like, I just don't think I'm a Bond fan.
Mm, yeah.
You know, I think I can enjoy the movies, but I think I'm not a Bond fan. Like I'm not going to get super excited if another Bond comes out unless they cast Idris Elba. Yeah. And then I'm going to go see it because I'm an Idris Elba fan, not because I'm a Bond fan. So
that'd be pretty great.
You know, so I think that was my conclusion, because ultimately I could go see Mission Impossible or I could go see this, and I would rather see the one that's not taking itself so seriously. But like I said, that's what we've been getting.
Yeah.
Well, I want to ask you guys one final quick question. It doesn't really have to be an incredible discussion or a very lengthy discussion, but there was that, and Mark, you alluded to this, there was that USA Today article that had Daniel Craig saying he'd rather slit his wrist than play Bond again. And then there was a couple of things that came after that where he was like, oh, just picking. So, in your opinion, Joel, will Daniel Craig be Bond again?
I think... this is like the natural time for him to bow out if he really wanted to, mm-hmm. because of the way that the film wraps itself up. And I think it would actually be much more exciting for audiences and Bond fans if they cast somebody else and went a different route. I'm not sure a fifth Craig film, you know, go out now, end it now, and mm-hmm. end out on top. You've got Casino Royale and Skyfall, two of the best Bond films that have been made so far. You got two other ones that are good-ish. Why ruin that with a fifth film if you're not really 100% into it? So I don't think he's going to come back. I actually hope he quits now and we find somebody else who can be the next awesome James Bond.
Gotcha. Mark?
I'm about 50-50 on that question, to be honest, because I think it could line up to where that it would be a good enough project that Daniel Craig would be interested in, and he would come back. I feel like I unfortunately as a fan agree that he should probably bow out at this point, but I kind of want him to come back just because it probably won't be fulfilled, but I hold out hope that he will recapture some of that Casino Royale raw energy. that I got a little bit more of in Quantum of Solace and to completely lost from Sam Mendes. Mm-hmm. So I think what has hurt Quantum and Skyfall and Spectre is they're the wrong directors for a James Bond movie. What are the two best James Bond movies, to be honest with you?
I'm under the impression that you would say Casino Royale.
One. And GoldenEye. Both directed by Martin Campbell.
That's a good point.
Yeah, I feel like he's the, like, whatever you capture from Martin Campbell, if Martin Campbell could come back, give me another Bond movie with Daniel Craig.
All right, well, that kind of wraps us up here.
Or if they relaunch it with another guy. So hire Martin Campbell again.
So the question isn't, will Daniel Craig come back, or do we want Daniel Craig back?
Is Martin Campbell
coming back? That's all we care about. You know, Tobey Maguire is Bond, as long as Mark Campbell's.
I mean, hey, honestly.
Little Vince Vaughn is Bond, you know. as long as Mark Campbell. Hey, I don't know. I'm just here.
We're just going to do some things and just make some decisions.
This is the most bad impression-filled episode ever, and I love it.
Does that technically count as like another dodgeball? Because is Vince Vaughn?
Well, I mean, okay, so doing the math, taking too long to explain this real quick.
Okay.
Vince Vaughn being the same character in every movie, which I'm fine with because I love his character in basically every movie.
Yeah, yeah.
That impression technically of Vince Vaughn could have been from any movie, so it counts as dodgeball.
Yes.
Yes, 1 point or 3 points to dodgeball. 3 dodgeball in the Spectre reference thing. Anyway, with that said, we wrap up, and I want to give our guests time to let you know how you can get a hold of them, where you can talk to them. So, Joel, what are you doing and how can people get a hold of you?
Yeah, I just launched a new film website called cinemaward.com. It's CINEMAYWARD.com. And it's just a collection of all the film reviews and essays, film discussion guides that I've got that I've been creating over the years. And finally, I'll put them in one place. So you can also find me on Twitter at Joel Mayward. Or at Cinemaward. Either way would be awesome. So, yeah.
Oh, that's great, man. With those many reviews, it would be really awesome if you had like a book or something that I could purchase.
Oh, yeah. I also. I am the worst self-promoter, man. I also wrote a book called Jesus Goes to the Movies, the Youth Ministry Film Guide. You can find that on Amazon.com or from the publisher. They're called The Youth Cartel. It's meant for people in youth ministry, but if you just love film and love talking about it and exploring it and the theology behind it and spiritual truths that can be found in films, it might be right up your alley. So yeah, awesome. Jesus Goes to the Movies. Excellent.
Cool. Mark?
You can find me on Twitter at Mark Wingdinger, and you can check me out on Real World. I have been writing quite a bit recently for the site. I'm doing a regular Whoology review right now for Doctor Who, the current season. That's all up right now and current. And then I did, if you want to know more about my James Bond thoughts, you can read my review on Die Another Day and the greatest James Bond movie, Casino Royale.
Quantum of Solace?
Yeah.
Awesome. So if you guys want to, you can follow me on Twitter. There's lots of ways to get a hold of me. You'll find that all at the website. As always, don't forget to subscribe and rate the podcast if you've enjoyed it. Please follow our excellent guests on social media and around the web, all the things they're doing. It would be well worth your time. Meanwhile, we're very thankful for you, the listeners, for taking time to make us a part of your week. So until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
Am I making sounds?
Whatever you just happened just made a sound. It sounded like a...
Oh, like this? Wait, let me do it. Is that it?
No.
No?
The only thing I can think of is that I have headphones on, and I pull, like, the cord against my desk, and it kind of made a brushing sound on my desk.
That could be it. It almost sounds like a zipper, like, running against, like, a desktop or something.
Mm-hmm.
That might be it. I've also been just, like, you know, continually taking my zipper up and down while farting you know, because that's what.
That's it.
Also, farting noises. I mean, probably not that. Probably not that. Something else.
Entertainment. It's not mindless.
It's not mindless.
That's bad. Impressions are done.
Entertainment is not mindless, Mark.
That was good. That was good.